diagnoses in myelin to a variety of disorders, including dyslexia, autism, attention deficit disorder, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and even pathological lying. While many researchers focused on myelin's link to disease, another group became interested in the role it might play in normal, even high-functioning individuals. More studies followed. In 2005, Frederick Ullen scanned the brains of concert pianists and found a directly proportional relationship between hours of practice and white matter. In 2000, Torkel Klingberg linked reading skill to white matter increases, and in 2006, Jesus Pujol did the same for vocabulary development. In 2005, the Cincinnati Children's Hospital study of 47 normal children aged 5 to 18 correlated increased IQ with increased organization and density of white matter. Other researchers, like Dr. Fields, uncovered the mechanism by which these myelin increases happened. As he described in a 2006 paper in the journal Neuron, supporter cells called oligodendrocytes and astrocytes sense the nerve firing and respond by wrapping more myelin on the fiber that fires. The more the nerve fires, the more myelin wraps around it. The more myelin wraps around it, the faster the signals travel, increasing velocities up to 100 times over signals sent through an uninsulated fiber. The studies piled up, gradually coalescing into a new picture. Myelin is infrastructure, all right, but with a powerful twist. Within the vast metropolis of the brain, myelin quietly transforms narrow alleys into broad, lightning-fast superhighways. Neural traffic that once trundled along at 2 miles an hour can, with myelin's help, accelerate to 200 miles an hour. The refractory time, the wait required between one signal and the next, decreases by a factor of 30. Together, the increased speed and decreased refractory time combine to boost overall information processing capability by 3,000 times. Broadband, indeed. What's more, myelin has the capacity to regulate velocity, speeding or occasionally even slowing signals so they hit synapses at the optimal time. Timing is vital, because neurons are binary. Either they fire or they don't. No gray area. Whether they fire depends solely on whether the incoming impulse is big enough to exceed their threshold of activation. To explain the implications, Fields had me imagine a skill circuit where two neurons have to combine their impulses to make a third high-threshold neuron fire, for, say, a golf swing. But here's the catch. In order to combine properly, those two incoming impulses must arrive at nearly exactly the same time, sort of like two small people running at a heavy door to push it open. That required time window turns out to be about 4 milliseconds, or about half the time it takes a bee to flap its wings once. If the first two signals arrive more than 4 milliseconds apart, the door stays shut. The crucial third neuron doesn't fire, and the golf ball soars into the rough. Your brain has so many connections and possibilities that your genes can't code the neurons to time things so precisely, Field said. But you can build myelin to do it. While the precise mechanism of optimization remains a mystery for now, Fields theorizes that a feedback loop is at work monitoring, comparing, and integrating outputs, the overall picture adds up to a process elegant enough to please Darwin himself. Nerve firings grow myelin. Myelin controls impulse speed, and impulse speed is skill. Myelin doesn't make synapses unimportant. To the contrary, Fields and other neurologists emphasize that synaptical changes remain key to learning. But myelin plays a massive role in how that learning manifests itself. As Fields put it, signals have to travel at the right speed, arrive at the right time, and myelination is the brain's way of controlling that speed. Myelin theory, as seen through the eyes of Dr. Fields, is impressive. But what stayed with me was what he showed me next. A glimpse into a deep practicing brain. We walked down the narrow hall to a colleague's office and saw what looked like an undersea image out of Jules Verne. Glowing green, squid-like shapes against a field of black, their tentacles reaching for slender fibers. The squids, Fields informed me, are oligodendrocytes. Oligos, in lab lingo, the cells that produce the myelin. When a nerve fiber fires, the oligo senses it, grabs hold, and starts wrapping. Each tentacle curls and extends as the oligo squeezes cytoplasm out of itself until only a cellophane-like sheet of myelin remains. That myelin, still attached to the oligo, proceeds to wrap over and over the nerve fiber with unworldly precision, spiraling down on each end to create the distinctive sausage shape, tightening itself like a threaded nut along the fiber. It's one of the most intricate and exquisite cell-to-cell processes there is, Field said, and it's slow. Each one of these wraps can go around the nerve fiber 40 or 50 times, and that can take days or weeks. Imagine doing that to an entire neuron, then an entire circuit with thousands of nerves. It would be like insulating a transatlantic cable. So there's the picture in a nutshell. Each time we deeply practice a nine-iron swing or a guitar chord or a chess opening, we are slowly installing broadband in our circuitry. We are firing a signal that those tiny green tentacles sense. They react by reaching toward the nerve fibers. They grasp, they squish, and they make another wrap, thickening the sheath. They build a little more insulation along the wire, which adds a bit more bandwidth and precision to the skill circuit, which translates into an infinitesimal bit more skill and speed. Struggle is not optional. It's neurologically required. In order to get your skill circuit to fire optimally, you must by definition fire the circuit suboptimally. You must make mistakes and pay attention to those mistakes. You must slowly teach your circuit. You must also keep firing that circuit, i.e., practicing, in order to keep myelin functioning properly. After all, myelin is living tissue. To sum up, it's time to rewrite the maxim that practice makes perfect. The truth is, practice makes myelin, and myelin makes perfect. And myelin operates by a few fundamental principles. The firing of the circuit is paramount. Myelin is not built to respond to fond wishes or vague ideas or information that washes over us like a warm bath. The mechanism is built to respond to actions, the literal electrical impulses traveling down nerve fibers. It responds to urgent repetition. In a few chapters, we'll discuss the likely evolutionary reasons, but for now we'll simply note that deep practice is assisted by the attainment of a primal state, one where we are attentive, hungry, and focused, even desperate. Myelin is universal. One size fits all skills. Our myelin doesn't know whether it's being used for playing shortstop or playing Schubert. Regardless of its use, it grows according to the same rules. Myelin is meritocratic. Circuits that fire get insulated. If you moved to China, your myelin would wrap fibers that help you conjugate Mandarin verbs. To put it another way, myelin doesn't care who you are. It cares what you do. Myelin wraps. It doesn't unwrap. Like a highway paving machine, myelination happens in one direction. Once a skill circuit is insulated, you can't uninsulate it, except through age or disease. That's why habits are hard to break. The only way to change them is to build new habits by repeating new behaviors, by myelinating new circuits. Age matters. In children, myelin arrives in a series of waves, some of them determined by genes, some dependent on activity. The waves last into our 30s, creating critical periods during which time the brain is extraordinarily receptive to learning new skills. Thereafter, we continue to experience a net gain of myelin until around the age of 50, when the balance tips toward loss. We retain the ability to myelinate throughout life. Thankfully, 5% of our oligos remain immature, always ready to answer the call. But anyone who has tried to learn a language or a musical instrument later in life can testify that it takes a lot more time and sweat to build the requisite circuitry. This is why the vast majority of world-class experts start young. Their genes do not change as they grow older, but their ability to build myelin does. On one level, the study of myelin sounds like an exotic new neuroscience. But on another level, myelin is similar to another evolution-built mechanism you use every day, muscles. If you use your muscles a certain way, by trying hard to lift things you can barely lift, those muscles will respond by getting stronger. If you fire your skill circuits the right way, by trying hard to do things you can barely do in deep practice, then your skill circuits will respond by getting faster and more fluent. Views about our use of muscles have changed. Until the 1970s, relatively few people ran marathons or pursued bodybuilding. Those who did and excelled were considered to possess a special gift. That worldview flipped when we learned how the human cardiovascular system actually works, that we can improve it by targeting our aerobic or anaerobic systems, that we can strengthen our heart and muscles by pushing ourselves to operate at the outer edges of our ability, lifting a slightly heavier weight, or trying to run a slightly farther distance. It turned out that regular people could become bodybuilders or marathoners gradually by tapping into the power of the mechanism. Thinking about skill as a muscle requires a big adjustment. You might say that we have to build a new circuit of understanding. For the last century and a half, we've understood talent through a Darwin-inspired model of genes and environment, aka nature and nurture. We've grown up believing that genes impart unique gifts, and that environment offers unique opportunities for expressing those gifts. We've instinctively chalked up the kind of success we see in remote, impoverished hotbeds like Brazil's soccer fields to the vague notion that underdogs try harder and want it more. Never mind that the world is brimming with millions of desperately poor people who try desperately hard to succeed at soccer. But the Myelin model shows that certain hotbeds succeed not only because people there are trying harder, but also because they are trying harder in the right way, practicing more deeply, and earning more skill. When we look more closely, those hotbeds aren't really underdogs at all. Like David, they have found the right leverage against Goliath. 2. Anders Ericsson's Big Adventure. Myelin science is still in its early days. As one neurologist told me, until a few years ago, all the world's myelin researchers could have fit into a single restaurant. When it comes to myelin, we know perhaps 2% of what we know about synapses, Field said. We're on the frontier. This doesn't mean the scientists who are studying myelin fail to see its massive potential, or that the new model doesn't influence the way they see the world. When Fields and I played pool at his house, he commented that he hasn't myelinated his pool-playing circuits that much. But it does mean that they harbor a deep yearning for a major, broad-based study to investigate myelin's relationship to human skill and learning. This is no small wish. The ideal myelin study would be biblical in scope. It would examine all types of skill in all conceivable environments. It would be a project worthy of Noah, requiring someone obsessed enough to track and measure each species of skill, then to metaphorically march a miles-long procession of ballplayers, artists, singers, chess players, and physicists into a single massive inquiry. To myelin researchers, now busily probing petri dishes, the notion of such a grand study is romantic, irresistible, and utterly outlandish. What kind of person, what kind of maniacally energetic Noah would take on such a project? This is where Anders Ericsson enters our story. Ericsson was born in 1947 in a northern suburb of Stockholm, Sweden. As a boy, Ericsson idolized famous explorers, in particular Sven Anders Hedin, Scandinavia's turn-of-the-century version of Indiana Jones. Hedin was an irresistible character, a supremely talented linguist, archaeologist, paleontologist, artist and geographer who had explored the far reaches of Mongolia, Tibet, and the Himalayas, routinely cheating death and writing highly regarded books. From within the confines of his small suburban bedroom, Ericsson studied Hedin's works, envisioning his own worlds to discover and explore. As he grew older, however, Ericsson's dreams encountered difficulties. Most of the world's frontiers appeared to have been explored, the blank spots on the map filled in. And unlike Hedin, Ericsson appeared to be mostly without talent. While he was decent at math, he was fairly hopeless at soccer and basketball, languages, biology, or music. When he was 15, Ericsson discovered he was good at chess, regularly winning lunchtime matches against his fellow students. It seemed he had discovered his talent, for a few weeks. Then one of the boys, one of the worst players in the group, in fact, suddenly improved and started trouncing Ericsson every time. Erickson was mad. He was also curious. "I really thought about this a lot," he said. "What had just happened? Why could that boy, whom I had beaten so easily, now beat me just as easily? I knew he was studying, going to chess club. But what had happened, really, underneath? From that point on, I deliberately tried to avoid getting really good at something. I gradually became more obsessed with studying experts than with being one." In the mid-1970s, Erickson was studying psychology at the Royal Institute of Technology. At the time, the field of psychology was in an awkward state of transition, stretched between two divergent schools of thought. On one hand, Sigmund Freud and his ghostly closet full of unconscious urges. On the other, B.F. Skinner and a steely-eyed behaviorist movement that treated humans as little more than collections of mathematical inputs and outputs. But the world was changing. In universities in England and the States, a movement called the Cognitive Revolution was beginning. This new theory, founded by a diverse group of psychologists, artificial intelligence experts, and neuroscientists, held that the human mind operated like a computer that had been designed by evolution, and that it obeyed certain universal rules. As fate would have it, Sweden itself was enjoying a golden age of success in art and sport. A skinny unknown named Bjorn Borg was winning Wimbledon. Ingmar Bergman ruled world cinema. Ingmar Stenmark dominated skiing, and ABBA was conquering pop music. In Erickson's mind, all of these disparate data mingled, giving him what he'd been looking for, fresh territory to explore. What was talent? What made successful people different from the rest of us? Where does greatness come from? "I was looking for an area that gave me freedom," Erickson said. "I was interested in how people accomplish great things, and at the time, that was viewed as outside the normal scope of inquiry." Erickson wrote his 1976 dissertation on the usefulness of verbal reports, people's accounts of their own mental states, as a tool for understanding their performance. His work caught the attention of psychologist-economist Herbert Simon, a pioneer of the cognitive revolution, who would shortly collect a Nobel Prize in economics for his work on decision-making. Simon recruited Erickson to come to America, and by 1977, Erickson was working alongside Simon at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, investigating basic questions of human problem-solving. Characteristically, Erickson's first project was to explore one of psychology's most sacred tenets, the belief that short-term memory is an innate fixed quality. A famed 1956 paper by the psychologist George Miller called The Magical Number 7, plus or minus 2, established the rule that human short-term memory was limited to 7 pieces of independent information, and gave Bell Telephone reason to settle on 7-digit phone numbers. The limit was called channel capacity, and the capacity was believed to be as fixed as height or shoe size. Erickson set out to test Miller's theory in the simplest possible way, by training student volunteers to increase their capacity for memorizing strings of digits as a new digit arrived once per second. To the scientific establishment, Erickson's experiment seemed eccentric, if not downright nuts, the equivalent of attempting to train people to increase their shoe size. Short-term memory was hardware. 7 digits was the limit. It didn't change. When one of Erickson's student volunteers memorized an 80-digit number, the scientific establishment wasn't sure what to think. When the second volunteer surpassed 100 digits, Miller's number 7 seemed to have been replaced by a magic of a different sort. People were blown away, Erickson remembered. They couldn't believe that there wasn't a universal limit. But it was true. Erickson showed that the existing model of short-term memory was wrong. Memory wasn't like shoe size. It could be improved through training. And this was when Erickson had an insight, a glimpse of an unexplored territory worthy of his hero Hedin. If short-term memory wasn't limited, then what was? Every skill was a form of memory. When a champion skier flew down a hill, she was using structures of memory, telling her muscles what to do and when. When a master cellist played, he also was using structures of memory. Why wouldn't they all be subject to the same sort of training effect? Traditional theory said that hardware was a limit, Erickson said. But if people are able to transform the mechanism that mediates performance by training, then we're in an entirely new space. This is a biological system, not a computer. It can construct itself. So began Erickson's 30-year odyssey through the kingdom of talent. Erickson explored all dimensions of skilled performance, studying nurses, gymnasts, violinists, and dart players, Scrabble players, typists, and SWAT officers. He did not measure their myelin. He's a psychologist, not a neurologist, and besides, diffusion tensor imaging hadn't been invented yet. Instead, he studied the talent process from an equally vital angle. He measured practice. Specifically, he measured the time and characteristics of practice. Along with his colleagues in this field, Erickson established a remarkable foundation of work, documented in several books and most recently in the appropriately Bible-sized Cambridge Handbook of Expertise and Expert Performance. Its central tenet is a Gibraltar-like statistic. Every expert in every field is the result of around 10,000 hours of committed practice. Erickson called this process deliberate practice and defined it as working on technique, seeking constant critical feedback, and focusing ruthlessly on shoring up weaknesses. For practical purposes, we can consider deliberate practice and deep practice to be basically the same thing, though since he's a psychologist, Erickson's term refers to the mental state, not to myelin. For the record, he is attracted to the idea. "I find the correlation between myelin and skill very interesting," he told me. Along with researchers like Herbert Simon and Bill Chase, Erickson validated hallmarks like the 10-year rule, an intriguing finding dating to 1899, which says that world-class expertise in every domain, violin, math, chess, and so on, requires roughly a decade of committed practice. Even the astonishing chess prodigy Bobby Fischer put in 9 hard years before achieving his grandmaster status at age 17. This rule is often used to determine the ideal start of training. For example, in tennis, girls peak physically at 17, so they ought to start at 7. Boys peak later, so 9 is okay. But the 10-year, 10,000-hour rule has more universal implications. It implies that all skills are built using the same fundamental mechanism, and further, that the mechanism involves physiological limits from which no one is exempt. In most minds, Erickson's work inspires a singular and instinctive objection. What about geniuses? What about young Mozart's famous ability to transcribe entire scores on a single hearing? What about savants who saunter up to a piano or a Rubik's Cube and are instantly magically brilliant? Erickson and his colleagues reply with cool, irrefutable stacks of numbers. In Genius Explained, Dr. Michael Howe of Exeter University estimates that Mozart, by his 6th birthday, had studied 3,500 hours of music with his instructor father, a fact that places his musical memory in the realm of impressive but obtainable skill. Savants tend to excel within narrow domains that feature clear logical rules, piano and math, as opposed to, say, improvisational comedy or fiction writing. Furthermore, savants typically accumulate massive amounts of prior exposure to those domains, through such means as listening to music in the home. The true expertise of these geniuses, the research suggests, resides in their ability to deep practice obsessively, even when it doesn't necessarily look like they're practicing. As Erickson succinctly put it, "There's no cell type that geniuses have that the rest of us don't." That's not to say that a minuscule percentage of people don't possess an innate, obsessive desire to improve, what psychologist Ellen Winner calls the rage to master. But these sorts of self-driven, deep practicers are rare and are blazingly self-evident. A rule of thumb, if you have to ask whether your child possesses the rage to master, he doesn't. If we overlay Erickson's research with the new myelin science, we get something approaching a universal theory of skill that can be summed up in a temptingly concise equation. Deep practice times 10,000 hours equals world-class skill. But the truth is, life's more complicated than that. The truth is, it's better to use this information as a lens through which we can illuminate how the talent code works, to uncover hidden connections between distant worlds, to ask strange questions like, What do the Bronte sisters have in common with skateboarders? Chapter 3. The Brontes, the Z-Boys, and the Renaissance. Excellence is a habit. Aristotle. The Girls from Nowhere. In the vast river of narratives that make up Western culture, most stories about talent are strikingly similar. They go like this. Without warning, in the midst of ordinary, everyday life, a kid from nowhere appears. The kid possesses a mysterious natural gift for painting, math, baseball, physics, and through the power of that gift, he changes his life and the lives of those around him. Of all the compelling stories of youthful talent, the story of the Bronte sisters is tough to beat. Its essential arc was established by Elizabeth Gaskell in her 1857 Life of Charlotte Bronte. It went like this. Far off in the remote moors of Haworth, West Yorkshire, within a drafty parsonage ruled by their icy, tyrannical father, three motherless sisters named Charlotte, Emily, and Anne wrote marvelous books before dying at a young age. In Gaskell's telling, the Bronte story was a tragic fable, and the most magical part was that the children produced several of the greatest works of English literature. Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, Agnes Grey, and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. The proof of their divine gift, Gaskell wrote, was the series of tiny books the Brontes created as children, books that wove fantastical stories of imaginary kingdoms called Glasstown, Angria, and Gondel. As Gaskell related, I've had a curious packet confided to me containing an immense amount of manuscript in an inconceivably small space, tales, dramas, poems, romances, written principally by Charlotte, in a hand which is almost impossible to decipher without the aid of a magnifying glass. When she gives way to her powers of creation, her fancy and her language alike run riot, sometimes to the very borders of apparent delirium. Tiny books, delirium, supernaturally gifted children. It's high-octane stuff. Gaskell's book established a sturdy template into which most subsequent Bronte biographies have faithfully slid, in part due to the scarcity of original documents. Gaskell's narrative has been employed for a film, a stage play, and a morality tale. There's just one problem with Gaskell's narrative. It isn't true. To put it more precisely, the real story of the Brontes is even better. The real story of the Brontes was uncovered by Juliet Barker, an Oxford-trained historian who spent 6 years as curator of the Bronte Parsonage Museum in Haworth. Scouring sources locally, as well as across Europe, Barker assembled a trove of material that had gone mostly unexamined. In 1994, she systematically demolished Gaskell's myth with a 1,003-page fire hose of scholarship called The Brontes. In Barker's work, a fresh picture comes into focus. The town of Haworth was not a remote outpost, but a moderately busy crossroads of politics and commerce. The Bronte home was a far more stimulating place than Gaskell portrayed, replete with books, current magazines, and toys, overseen by a benign, tolerant father. But the myth Barker upends most completely is the assertion that the Brontes were natural-born novelists. The first little books weren't just amateurish, a given since their authors were so young. They lacked any signs of incipient genius. Far from original creations, they were bald imitations of magazine articles and books of the day, in which the three sisters and their brother Branwell copied themes of exotic adventure and melodramatic romance, mimicking the voices of famous authors and cribbing characters wholesale. Barker's work conclusively establishes two facts about the Brontes' little books. First, they wrote a great deal in a variety of forms, 22 little books averaging 80 pages each in one 15-month period. And second, their writing, while complicated and fantastical, wasn't very good. As Barker put it, their slapdash writing, appalling spelling, and non-existent punctuation well into their late teenage years is usually glossed over by Bronte biographers, as is the frequent immaturity of thought and characterization. These elements in the juvenilia do not detract from the Brontes' achievement in producing such a volume of literature at so early an age, but they do extensively undermine the view that they were born novelists. Deep practice and myelin give us a better way to look at the Brontes. The unskilled quality of their early writing isn't a contradiction of the literary heights they eventually achieved. It's a prerequisite to it. They became great writers not in spite of the fact that they started out immature and imitative, but because they were willing to spend vast amounts of time and energy being immature and imitative, building myelin in the confined, safe space of their little books. Their childhood writings were collaborative deep practice, where they developed storytelling muscles. As Michael Howe wrote of the Brontes in Genius Explained, the fact that the creative activity of writing about an invented world was a joint exercise contributed enormously to the author's enjoyment. It was a marvelous game in which each participant eagerly ingested and responded to their sibling's latest installment. To write a book, even a tiny one, is to play a particular kind of game. Rules must be formed and obeyed. Characters must be conceived and constructed. Landscapes must be described. Lines of narrative must be puzzled out and followed. Each of these can be thought of as a distinct action, the firing of a circuit that's linked to other circuits. Written far from parental eyes, removed from any formal pressure, the little books functioned as the equivalent of a link trainer, a place where the Bronte sisters fired and honed millions upon millions of circuits, tangled and untangled thousands of authorial knots, and created hundreds of works that were utter artistic failures, except for two redeeming facts. Each one made them happy, and each one quietly earned them a bit of skill. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. When Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights was published in 1847, reviewers marveled at the author's originality. Here was a complex masterpiece of imaginative storytelling featuring the frightening, fascinating character of Heathcliff, a brooding outsider whose only redeeming characteristic was his love for free-spirited Catherine, who tragically marries the wealthy, refined Edgar Linton. Critics were right to marvel, but wrong about the originality. In the scribbles of the little books, we can find all the elements waiting to be assembled. The misty poetic landscape, called Gondal. The dark hero, christened Julius Brenzeda. The headstrong heroine, Augusta Geraldine Almeida. And the rich suitor, Lord Alfred. Seen in this light, it's not surprising that Emily Bronte was able to write the story so well. After all, she had been deep practicing it for quite some time. The Myelin Skaters. In the mid-1970s, the world of skateboarding was turned upside down by a small group of kids who called themselves the Z-Boys, a band of lanky, sun-bleached teenagers from a surf shop near Venice, California. The Z-Boys skated in a way no one had ever seen. They did aerial maneuvers. They scraped their boards along curbs and handrails. They carried themselves with a punk outsider sensibility that we now recognize as the sport's lingua franca. Most usefully, they had a gift for dramatic timing, making their debut at the Bon Cadillac Skateboard Championship in Del Mar, California, in the summer of 1975. According to witnesses, the Z-Boys were mysterious outsiders, raw-boned geniuses, who had descended on the previously sedate sport with all the impact, if not the subtlety, of Genghis Khan. As the London Guardian summed up in its review of a documentary film on the Z-Boys, as Jay Adams slips into a loose crouch, grabs both ends of his board, and hops up and down in a burst of explosive energy speeding across the platform, the implication is clear already. In his charge, a skateboard is no longer a piece of sporting equipment like a tennis racket. Instead, it's more like an electric guitar, an instrument for aggressive, irreverent, spontaneous self-expression. But such expression was, in fact, far from spontaneous. Most of the Z-Boys were dedicated ocean surfers, having logged hundreds of hours on their boards. On days when the waves failed to show, they had simply transferred their aggressive, low-slung surfer style to the street. Another factor in their rise to greatness was more accidental. The discovery in the early 1970s of a unique tool, a myelin accelerant that allowed them to improve their circuitry at a ferocious speed. that tool was an empty swimming pool. Thanks to a combination of drought, fire, and overbuilt real estate, the neighborhoods of Bel Air and Beverly Hills were rife with empty pools. Finding them was easy. The Z-Boys drove down side streets with a scout standing on the roof of their car, scanning over fences for likely venues. Riding the pool's steep, curved walls was difficult at first. The first days brought some spectacular wipeouts, not to mention more than a few police calls from surprised homeowners. But sometime in 1975, in a moment that qualifies as skateboarding's version of the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, the Z-Boys achieved liftoff. "When we hit the pools, it became a really serious activity, the most serious activity," said Skip Engblom, part owner of the surf shop and the group's de facto mentor. "Every time, we had to go bigger, faster, longer. We were like a painter with a new canvas." In Skateboard Kings, a 1978 British documentary, a skater identified as Ken described the experience. "Pool riding is definitely the hardest thing to do," he said. "It takes whole-body coordination, so different than any other part of skateboarding. But, like, when I'm doing it, I flash on certain things. Like, I'm coming up to the top, I hit the top, and I feel if it's a good connection or not. And that will either send me into a slide across the top, or else I go for air. You're just out there. And then you just want to make it, and you feel more air and more air. And if you have it under control, you just totally go for it." Consider the pattern of actions that Ken describes. The space and shape of the pool constrain his efforts and narrow his focus to certain flashes, to certain connections that are either made or not made. It's fly high or fall hard. There are no gray areas, no mushiness. Once inside the pool, sliding along the steep surface, the Z-Boys had to play by the rules of the new game. From a deep practice point of view, the empty swimming pool created a world not unlike that of the little books of the Bronte sisters, or the futsal courts of Brazil. Circuits are fired and honed, mistakes are made and corrected. Myelin flourishes, talent blooms. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. For the last few hundred years, Western culture has understood and explained talent using the idea of unique identity, the tumble of cosmic dice that make everyone different, and a few lucky people special. According to that way of thinking, the Brontes and the Z-Boys succeeded because they were exceptional, mysteriously gifted outsiders, destiny-kissed kids from nowhere. Seen through the lens of deep practice, however, the story flips. Uniqueness still matters, but its significance resides in the way the Brontes and the Z-Boys do the things necessary to build their remarkable skills. Firing the right signals, honing circuits, making tiny books and filling them with childish stories, searching out empty swimming pools so that they can spend hours riding and falling inside them. The truth is, plenty of other Yorkshire girls had lives just as parochial and constricted as the Brontes. Just as plenty of other Los Angeles kids were as edgy and cool as the Z-Boys. But Myelin doesn't care about who you are. It only cares about what you do. We've seen how deep practice and Myelin illuminate the talents of small groups of people. Now, let's apply those ideas to two slightly larger groups. First, we'll look at the artists of the Italian Renaissance. Then we'll look at a slightly bigger group, the human species. The Michelangelo System. A few years ago, a Carnegie Mellon University statistician named David Banks wrote a short paper entitled "The Problem of Excess Genius." Geniuses are not scattered uniformly through time and space, he pointed out. To the contrary, they tend to appear in clusters. The most important question we can ask of historians is, why are some periods and places so astonishingly more productive than the rest, Banks wrote. It is intellectually embarrassing that this is almost never posed squarely, although its answer would have thrilling implications for education, politics, science, and art. Banks singled out three main clusters of greatness: Athens, from 440 BC to 380 BC, Florence, from 1440 to 1490, and London, from 1570 to 1640. Of these three, none is so dazzling or well-documented as Florence. in the space of a few generations, a city with a population slightly less than that of present-day Stillwater, Oklahoma, produced the greatest outpouring of artistic achievement the world has ever known. A solitary genius is easy to understand, but dozens of them in the space of two generations? How could it happen? Banks listed the conventional wisdom explanations for the Renaissance. Prosperity, which provided money and markets to support art. Peace, which provided the stability to seek artistic and philosophical progress. Freedom, which liberated artists from state or religious control. Social mobility, which allowed talented poor people to enter the arts. The paradigm thing, which brought new perspectives and mediums that created a wave of originality and expression. All of these seem to be likely causes, Banks wrote, and it is superficially plausible that by remarkable good fortune they converged to spark the Renaissance. Unfortunately, he continued, the actual existence of most of these factors is contradicted by the historical record. While socially mobile, in Florence the 1400s wasn't unusually prosperous, peaceful, or free. In fact, the city was recovering from a disastrous plague, was divided by vigorous fighting among powerful families, and was ruled by the church's iron fist. So, the usual thinking goes, perhaps it's the reverse. Perhaps it's the infighting, plagues, and restrictive church that formed the convergence. And yet, this logic, too, collapses under its own weight, since there are plenty of other places that had these factors present, and yet did not produce anything resembling Florence's collection of great artistic talent. Banks' paper neatly illustrates the endless cycle of tail-chasing that ensues when you apply traditional nature-nurture thinking to questions of talent. The more you try to distill the vast ocean of potential factors into a golden concentrate of uniqueness, the more contradictory the evidence becomes, and the more you are nudged toward the seemingly inescapable conclusion that geniuses are simply born, and that phenomena like the Renaissance were thus a product of blind luck. As historian Paul Johnson writes, giving voice to that theory, genius suddenly comes to life and speaks out of a vacuum, and then it is silent, equally mysteriously. Now let's look at the problem through the prism of deep practice. Milan doesn't care about prosperity, peace, or paradigms. It doesn't care what the church was doing, or who died in the plague, or how much money anyone had in the bank. It asks the same questions we ask of the Brontes and the Z-Boys. What did Florentine artists do? How did they practice? And for how long? As it turns out, Florence was an epicenter for the rise of a powerful social invention called craft guilds. Guilds, the word means gold, were associations of weavers, painters, goldsmiths, and the like, who organized themselves to regulate competition and control quality. Guilds worked like employee-owned corporations. They had management, dues, and tight policies dictating who could work in the craft. What they did best, however, was grow talent. Guilds were built on the apprenticeship system, in which boys around 7 years of age were sent to live with masters for fixed terms of 5 to 10 years. An apprentice worked directly under the tutelage and supervision of the master, who frequently assumed rights as the child's legal guardian. Apprentices learned the craft from the bottom up, not through lecture or theory, but through action, mixing paint, preparing canvases, sharpening chisels. They cooperated and competed within a hierarchy, rising after some years to the status of journeyman and eventually, if they were skilled enough, master. This system created a chain of mentoring. Da Vinci studied under Verrocchio. Verrocchio studied under Donatello. Donatello studied under Ghiberti. Michelangelo studied under Ghirlandaio. Ghirlandaio studied under Baldovinetti, and so on, all of them frequently visiting one another's studios in a cooperative, competitive arrangement that today would be called social networking. In short, apprentices spent thousands of hours solving problems, trying and failing, and trying again within the confines of a world built on the systematic production of excellence. Their life was roughly akin to that of a 12-year-old intern who spends a decade under the direct supervision of Steven Spielberg, painting sets, sketching storyboards, setting cameras. The notion that such a kid might one day become a great film director would hardly be a surprise. It would be closer to unavoidable. See Ron Howard. Consider Michelangelo. From ages 6 to 10, he lived with a stonecutter and his family, learning how to handle a hammer and chisel before he could read and write. After a brief, unhappy attempt at schooling, he apprenticed to the great Ghirlandaio. He worked on blockbuster commissions, sketching, copying, and preparing frescoes in one of Florence's largest churches. He was then taught by master sculptor Bertoldo and tutored by other luminaries at the home of Lorenzo de' Medici, where Michelangelo lived until he was 17. He was a promising but little-known artist until he produced the Pietà at age 24. People called the Pietà pure genius, but its creator begged to differ. "If people knew how hard I had to work to gain my mastery," Michelangelo later said, "it would not seem so wonderful at all." The apprenticeship system, with its long period of study, early acquaintance with varied materials, copying, and collaborative work, somehow allowed boys who were probably quite ordinary in every respect to be turned into men possessing a high degree of artistic skill, wrote Bruce Cole in The Renaissance Artist at Work. Art, so the Renaissance believed, could be taught by a series of progressive steps, from grinding colors to making copies to work on the master's design to inventing one's own paintings or sculptures. We tend to think of the great Renaissance artists as a homogeneous group, but the truth is that they were like any other randomly selected group of people. They came from rich and poor families alike. They had different personalities, different teachers, different motivations. But they had one thing in common. They all spent thousands of hours inside a deep practice hothouse, firing and optimizing circuits, correcting errors, competing and improving skills. They each took part in the greatest work of art anyone can construct, the architecture of their own talent. Meet Mr. Myelin. George Bartsokas is a professor of neurology at UCLA. Most of the time, Bartsokas, who's in his 50s, resembles the sober, distinguished researcher and teacher he is. Shirt and tie, neatly combed hair, courtly manner. But when he talks about Myelin, something within him quickens. He leans forward hungrily. His eyes gleam. He smiles hugely. He looks as if he might suddenly leap out of his chair. Bartsokas does not want to behave in this way, but he can't help it. Around UCLA, he's known as Mr. Myelin. "Why do teenagers make bad decisions?" he asks, not waiting for an answer. "Because all the neurons are there, but they are not fully insulated. Until the whole circuit is insulated, that circuit, although capable, will not be instantly available to alter impulsive behavior as it's happening. Teens understand right and wrong, but it takes them time to figure it out. Why is wisdom most often found in older people? Because their circuits are fully insulated and instantly available to them. They can do very complicated processing on many levels, which is really what wisdom is. The volume of myelin in the brain continues to increase until around 50. And you have to remember that it's alive. It is breaking down, and we are rebuilding it. Complex tasks, like ruling countries or writing novels, these are most often better done by people who have built the most myelin. Why can't monkeys, which have every neuron type and neurotransmitter we have, use language the way we do?" he continues. "Because we've got 20% more myelin. To talk like we are now takes a lot of information processing speed, and they have no broadband. Sure, you can teach a monkey to communicate at the level of a 3-year-old, but beyond that, they are using the equivalent of copper wires." Bartsokas keeps going, posing more questions, providing more answers, some documented, others awaiting the proof he knows will soon come. "Why do breastfed babies have higher IQs? Because the fatty acids in breast milk are the building blocks of myelin. This is why the FDA recently approved the addition of omega-3 fatty acids to infant formula, and also why eating fish, which is rich in fatty acids, has been linked to lowered risk of memory loss, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease. Bartsokas takes DHA fatty daily. The lesson in all cases is the same. The more myelin you have on board, the smarter you can be." Why did Michael Jordan retire? His muscles didn't change, but as with every other human being, his myelin started to break down with age. Not much, but enough to prevent him from firing impulses at the speeds and frequencies required for Michael Jordan-esque explosive movement. Why was puny Cro-Magnon man able to survive when bigger, stronger, larger-brained Neanderthals died out? Because Cro-Magnons had more myelin. They could outthink, outcommunicate, and ultimately outcompete the Neanderthals. Bartzokas is awaiting DNA testing of a Neanderthal tooth that he says may confirm his hypothesis. Why can horses walk immediately on being born, while humans take a year? A horse is born with its muscles already myelinated, online, and ready to go. A baby's muscles, on the other hand, don't get myelinated for a year or so, and the circuits get optimized only with practice. In selecting for myelin, evolution made the same choice that any engineer designing the Internet would make, Bartzokas says. It traded size of the computer for bandwidth. I don't care how big your computers are. What I want is to have them available instantaneously so I can fully process things now. That's what the Internet is. Instant access to lots of computers. We operate by the same principles as Google does. We are myelin beings, Bartzokas says finally. It's the way we're built. You can't avoid it. We are myelin beings. This is a big statement. It offers a potentially revolutionary alternative to the traditional way we think about skill, talent, and human nature itself. To see what Mr. Myelin really means by it, however, we must first backtrack a moment. Since Darwin, the traditional way of thinking about talent has gone something like this. Genes, nature, and environment, nurture, combine to make us who we are. In this view, genes are the cosmic cards we are dealt, and the environment is the game in which they are played. Every once in a while, fate produces a perfect combination of genes and environment, resulting in high levels of talent and or genius. Nature nurture has been a terrifically popular model because it's clear and dramatic, and it speaks to a wide variety of phenomena in the natural world. But when it comes to explaining human talent, it has a slight problem. It's vague to the point of meaninglessness. Thinking that talent comes from genes and environment is like thinking that cookies come from sugar, flour, and butter. It's true enough, but not sufficiently detailed to be useful. To get beyond the outmoded nature-nurture model, we need to begin with a clear picture of how genes actually work. Genes are not cosmic playing cards. They are evolution-tested instruction books that build the immensely complicated machines that are us. They contain the blueprints, literally written in nucleotides, to construct our minds and bodies in the smallest detail. The task of design and construction is hugely complex, but essentially straightforward. The genes instruct the cells to make the eyelash like this, the toenail like that. When it comes to behavior, however, genes are forced to deal with a unique design challenge. Human beings move around through a big, varied world. They encounter all sorts of dangers, opportunities, and novel experiences. Things happen quickly, which means that behavior, skills, need to change quickly. The challenge is, how do you write an instruction book for behavior? How do our genes, sitting quietly inside our cells, help us adapt to an ever-changing, ever-dangerous world? To help address this problem, our genes have evolved to do a sensible thing. They contain instructions to build our circuitry with preset urges, proclivities, instincts. Genes construct our brains so that when we encounter certain stimuli, a tasty meal, rotting meat, a stalking tiger, or a potential mate, a factory-loaded neural program kicks into gear, using emotions to guide our behavior in a useful direction. We feel hunger when we smell a meal, disgust when we smell rotten meat, fear when we see a tiger. Desire when we see a potential mate. Guided by these preset neural programs, we navigate toward a solution. That strategy works well for creating behaviors to deal with rotten meat and potential mates. After all, writing instructions to build an urge circuit is relatively simple. If X, then Y. But what about creating complex higher behaviors like playing the saxophone or Scrabble? As we've seen, higher skills are made of million neuron chains working together with exquisite millisecond timing. The question of acquiring higher skills is really a question of design strategy. What's the best strategy for writing instructions to build a machine that can learn immensely complicated skills? One obvious design strategy would be for the genes to pre-wire for the skill. The genes would provide detailed step-by-step instructions to build the precise circuits needed to perform the desired skill, to play music, or juggle, or do calculus. When the right stimulus came along, all the pre-built wiring would connect up and start firing away, and the talent would appear. Babe Ruth starts whacking homers. Beethoven starts composing symphonies. This design strategy would seem to make sense. After all, what could be more straightforward? But in fact, it has two big problems. First, it's expensive, biologically speaking. Building those elaborate circuits takes resources and time, which have to come at the expense of some other design feature. Second, it's a gamble with fate. Pre-wiring to create a genius software programmer doesn't help if it's 1850, and pre-wiring for a genius blacksmith would be useless today. In the space of a generation or a few hundred miles, certain higher skills flip from being crucial to being trivial and vice versa. To put it simply, pre-wiring a million-wire circuit for a complex higher skill is a stupid and expensive bet for genes to make. Our genes, however, having survived the gauntlet of the past few million years, aren't in the business of making stupid and expensive bets. Other genes might have been, but they're long gone by now, along with the lineages that carried them. Now let's consider a different design strategy. Instead of pre-wiring for specific skills, what if the genes dealt with the skill issue by building millions of tiny broadband installers and distributing them throughout the circuits of the brain? The broadband installers wouldn't be particularly complicated. In fact, they'd all be identical, wrapping wires with insulation to make the circuits work faster and smoother. They would work according to a single rule. Whatever circuits are fired most and most urgently are the ones where the installers will go. Skill circuits that are fired often will receive more broadband. Skills that are fired less often, with less urgency, will receive less broadband. Such broadband installers would be useful if they were preset to work most vigorously during youth, when we're adapting to our environment. They'd be efficient if they worked outside of our consciousness, without cluttering up the limited window of everyday experience. After all, from a natural selection point of view, it doesn't matter if we feel ourselves gaining the crucial skill, only that we gain it, similar to the workings of, say, our immune system. From our limited vantage point, the increased skill would feel exactly like a gift, as if we were expressing some natural-born quality. But it would not be a gift. The real gift would be the tiny broadband installers, busily insulating whatever circuits were being fired, whether for hunting, math, music, or sport. Like all useful adaptations, the broadband installer system would quickly have become standard operating equipment among the entire species. We are myelin beings. The broadband is myelin, and the installers are the green, squid-like oligodendrocytes, sensing the signals we send and insulating the corresponding circuits. When we acquire higher skills, we are co-opting this ancient adaptive mechanism to our individual ends, an event made possible by the fact that our genes let us, or more accurately, they let our needs and our actions determine what skills we grow. This system is flexible, responsive, and economical because it gives all human beings the innate potential to earn skill where they need it. The proof lies in the talent hotbeds, in the 10,000 hours people spend deep practicing their way to world-class expertise, even in the strained Clint Eastwood facial expressions they share. These similarities are not accidental. They are the logical expression of a shared evolutionary mechanism built to respond to certain kinds of signals. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. This is not to say that every person on the planet has the potential to become an Einstein, whose autopsied brain was found to contain an unusual amount of you-know-what. Nor does it mean that our genes don't matter. They do. The point, rather, is that although talent feels and looks predestined, in fact we have a good deal of control over what skills we develop, and we each have more potential than we might ever presume to guess. We are all born with the opportunity to become, as Mr. Myelin likes to put it, lords of our own internet. The trick is to figure out how to do that. Chapter 4. The Three Rules of Deep Practice. Try Again, Fail Again, Fail Better, Samuel Beckett. Adrian DeGroot and the HSE. Any discussion about the skill-acquiring process must begin by addressing a curious phenomenon that I came to know as the holy shit effect. This refers to the heady mix of disbelief, admiration, and